Mr. Despard knew real form?
Yes, he apparently got lost in the forest and they saw him about 24 hours later. After that, the German bombed the second camp. There, the picture is slightly different. People retreated in good order and did what they were told to do. But by that time, all telephone communication between the various camps was cut off, and so we only had the liaison through motorcycles. Then eventually, they came around and bombed the third camp, where I was. That was the headquarters. And there, we, knowing what was going to happen, we withdrew in good order to some other place, Fontbruneau, where I sent a message to London telling them what was happening. And then we waited for the other companies to rejoin us. In the meantime, we had shot down one plane and seriously damaged another, as it never appeared again. He went away with smoke trailing behind. And the last battle was near the Fontbruneau at La Prune, where there, I think, that particular company killed about 50 Germans. Well, they fought up till the time they ran out of ammunition. Altogether, on that particular day, I think we lost about 3 killed and about a dozen wounded. But 50 German at least were left on the field. And we retreated through Mazamet, where the population more or less acclaimed us, although the German were still in garrison there. Because the German, they must have left. They left one opening from where we were. They barricaded all around us except the Mazamet, because they thought, no doubt, we wouldn't go through there, as it was a German garrison town. But we went through Mazamet and we went back to the Pic du Nord, where we first grouped. There, we decided to split up, and the various company or platoon went under the leaders to various places.
Who were you with?
I went to a farm with an American pilot we rescued on D-Day, who he was supposed to strafe the Normandy beaches, but instead of going back to England, he must have made some slight mistake in navigation, find himself short of petrol over the Pyrenees. So he dropped down before his plane dropped down. He was taken by local people, hidden away. And then by the time I got back to the camp, he had nobody to talk to explain what happened to him. So when I got there, I was more or less his great savior. He was happy from then on. And he went in practically every encounter we had. He liked guerrilla warfare. So with him, as he was only spoke English, we went to a farm and we stayed there quite a while, 2 or 3 weeks, where I was working my wireless, telling them what was happening. But London at that time didn't believe me anymore, because they heard from the communists that I had been wiped out, killed, and the whole setup was finished. And they started pillaging our arms depot, and the German had blown up our reserve of explosives, so we had very little left. We had no more explosive left, because our explosive store was all wired up to be blown up by us in case of needs, and German just dropped a bomb on it and the whole lot went to pieces.
Why should the communists have sent that report?
That's a very long story. all to do with politics in France in those days. We had some communists with us, but at one time they decided and they wanted to go away, and London gave us the order to let them go away and take with them their sidearms. So they went away with their rifle and a few rounds of ammunition. But some of them knew where some of our cash were, and whether they were the people who put round the rumour that I was dead, or whether there were other people who knew where the cash were. Anyway, they went there, and that one day we had a slight fight, because some of my people went to the cache to get their arms, and they found the communists there pillaging the thing. So they had a few rounds were far, and they were killed dead on both sides. And I was told off by London. What happened? Could I tell the full story? And what had happened? Well, I don't know what had happened. It so happened. And from then on, the rumor went round, and I was dead. The Corps Fontenoy didn't exist anymore. The people who went away on their own with their leaders, some of them never came back again. They stayed with the other Mackie. Some made some mistakes and they were killed because they didn't observe the rules of the game. But eventually, we all regrouped in the Mont Lacone, which is on the north of the Aude department, other mountains similar to the Black Mountains. And then we regrouped and we went on fighting. We fought the columns coming back from Bordeaux, one of the SS, I think it was Das Reich, came through our region. We didn't do too well that day.
Why not?
Well, we had a place on a bridge over a river in a very sharp, ravine. And by the time we got our troops being deployed on top of it, the German had already done the same thing on their side, having seen the bridge burn up or this partly destroyed. They had already taken their own precautions. So by the time we got there, we were in the open while they were hidden. And that's where we suffer most of our casualties. Practically every officer there was wounded, some badly, and quite a number of people died.
Well, what was this location?
Pont de la Mouline.
Where is it?
Pont de la Mouline, it's... There's really no big town anywhere near it, but it's in the Mont Lacone, which is a mountain. It's the last mountains before you get to in between the Pyrenees and the Massif Central. Then we had a very big battle in Saint-Pons, where I think the troops there were regular German coming back up from Carcassonne, but they were second-rate troops. We had a very big battle there, lasting at least 2 days. Then we went back to Saint-Pons, and all our wounded in the hospital there, including German wounded. And then the town people said to us that we had to go, because another column was coming up, and the other column came, and I don't think they did Saint-Pons any good, but we had been asked to withdraw, so we withdrew. That was about the last big battle we delivered. By that time, Toulouse had been liberated by other people. Although most of my people came from Toulouse, we never had the honor of liberating Toulouse because other people did it. Well, at least they pretended to. There's no fighting in Toulouse. There was some sharpshooters on top of the roof, and they kill each other. Some German army people were left behind, some milice were left behind, and some of the civilians got killed in the street. I had to go to Toulouse to find a permit to run my motor car, and the man I found behind the desk was a so-called colonel, who was a sergeant in our own setup. He was one of the chap who we expelled. He did give me my permit to run my motor car.
What had he been expelled for?
Misconduct.
Of what kind?
Going away at night, and going, or going home, or doing things he's not supposed to do. Then we went to Carcassonne, and I said goodbye to them, and they were joining with the addition of another company from the Aude district. They formed one battalion, which joined the French First Army under Delard de Sassigny, and they started fighting from Dijon onwards up till the end of the war in Germany. And they got Delard de Sassigny allowed them to have a shoulder flash saying Montagne Noire, and they from ordinary infantry they became hussards.
Hussards.
With their badges were a kind of Polish square hats with number 1 squadron. And that was the Delard de Sassigny. I asked a man in France the other day who knew about it, and I say, does it still exist? He said, oh yes, it still exists. There's still the fourragère, you know, the ribbons, and the Montagne Noire. Only one platoon now has it. And well, that was that. I got back to England in September, and by December I was in the Far East. But I don't suppose you're interested about the Far East.
I, just reverting back to the German bombing of that first camp. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about the casualties there?
Well, I think I saw, beside Henri Sevenet, couldn't find out, we only found out the day or so after, where we were told by the German commandant, and he was buried with full military honours. And it's a farmer, a local farmer, who say he was in a muck heap. That was the full military honours. The other casualties were, I think I saw 3 bodies being carbonised. All burnt up with no heads. Their heads were cut off. They were apparently only wounded, but the German just killed them.
Whilst you were operating as a British agent in France, did you come across antagonism towards you in the latter days from the Gaullists who entered France?
No, I realized there was a problem after the war. I mean, we never had any. What we did have was the fact that there were several Mackie around us who were Gaullists, so-called Gaullist Mackie. When we were attacked in the Montagne Noire, they didn't even offer to help, and yet they were about 50 yards from where the reserve German army were there, inside their lorries, so they could have got rid of at least 1,000 people there without too much trouble to themselves. They didn't budge. They also blame us to be une force amie mais étrangère. In other words, we were a friendly force, but a foreign force, more or less instigated by the intelligence service, which of course we were not. There was that kind of resentment. Also the fact that we wanted to do our own things, and we didn't want to be under the political control of the French, who were only thinking about what position they would have in the politics after the war. I mean, we were not interested in that. Because amongst my own people, we had communists to start with, they left. But we had socialists, we had royalists, we had Bonapartists, we had
right, left,
and right, what have left. You. We had Jews, we had Muslim, we had Protestants, we had Catholics, we had unbelievers, we had Russian, we had French, Yugoslav, British and American. So we were really a multinational thing. And our orders came from London, and we were obeying the orders from the High Command, which we got from Koenig. So we had nothing to do with the rest of them, as they didn't help us. We helped them, but they didn't help us. And we didn't want to be mixed up in politics. So up till after the war, I, except for these things, which were really only the beginning of opening my mind, I mean, I didn't realize there were any political background to it. Yes, but as only had to do with sympathizer, I got no complaint about the French people I knew during the war. They were all pro-British, and towards the end they were pro-American, because they talked of liberators, the planes, as opposed to liberators, the people. And I believe the love of the Allies was more towards the American than towards the British. Because even today, in France, when you go and visit the museums of wartime, Mackie and what have you, SOE is never mentioned. It's all the French who've done it all. I know jolly well if we hadn't been in Cannes in 42, I mean, there would be no resistance in France, in that part of France whatsoever. A French writer wrote, and I quite believe him, because he was even more pessimistic than I was, he said there was 1 per million people in France who were anti-German to start in 1940, in May 40. So that is, there were 50 million inhabitants in those days. So there were 50 people in the whole of France, mostly in the north and in Alsace-Lorraine. In the south, they couldn't care less. If we hadn't been there to do something about it and help them once the service obligatoire was introduced and their people didn't want to go and work in Germany, they disappeared in the mountains. Nobody would feed them, so we had to feed them, we had to clothe them, we had to do something towards it. Who did that? The British. Because even the French Mackie, run by de Gaulle, they got their money, their arms, their ammunition and their money from London. But France has forgotten that. And nowadays, I mean, I think they're more pro-German than pro-British. Except in certain parts of the world. In my last speech a few months ago with my private army, because we still meet, I don't go every year, but they meet every year, I had to tell them that, and they all came back and say, oh, well, not us, we are pro-British. But unfortunately in France it's not the case.
Can you tell me about how SOE made use of you in the Far East?
Well, we left sometimes at the end of 44 and by boat to Bombay. From Bombay we went to a camp, and then eventually we made our way by train to Madras and Ceylon. In Ceylon we were billeted in a jungle camp, and we learned about jungle warfare. We had several training exercises in the jungle. And on Wednesday we went there to collect the herbs to make the curry. We also had to learn a rudiment of Burmese language. Eventually I was dropped in Burma in May, I think it's May 45, because I remember I dropped with Bwete, Nicolas Berde. He received me near the Elephant Point in the south of the Irrawaddy Delta, and we walked with his small force to Twante. And there, as it was my birthday the day after, or within a week after, I had a cake of rice made by some Anglo-Burmese. So I remember more or less the date. It was in May. We stayed there at several places, and also to Nyumya, where we were based in Nyumya afterwards. And we went towards Rangoon, where the Japanese were still there, to see the lay of the land. Came back to Nyumya, then we were called tall about the Rangoon landing, and we tried to tell them that it was not necessary, as the Japanese were evacuating the place, and Elephant Points only had 5 Japanese left on the shore battery there, so there was no use at all to do so. When they told us that the landing was taking place that the next morning, would we please go and receive some of the airborne troops somewhere on the delta, and the Gurkha landed. Well, they landed all very badly. I think about a quarter of them broke out of their necks or their legs. They were landed all over the place. It was still fairly dark. And as they landed all over the place, when they heard movement, they started firing at each other, and so they killed another 25% amongst themselves. The plane from Calcutta had bombed all the villages around who were our friends, so there was a lot of casualties there as well. We told them there was no mine in the Twente Canal, but the Irrawaddy itself was mine. So nevertheless, they sent the fleet up, and I think they blew about 2 ships on the mine. Eventually, they got there. The general in charge more or less treated us as irrelevant. He didn't want to know anything about it. So we left Rangoon.
Who was he?
I've forgotten his name. I think it might have been Robertson, but I don't know. Watteau and I then left back, and we spent the night in some family in Rangoon somewhere. And the next morning, I was told on Hong San, who's, you know, the Burmese leader, his troops had started pillaging and revolting and killing people in Twente or Nyumya. Would we please go back and re-establish order? So I said, what, the two of us? I said, yes, the two of you. So I said, all right, give us a plane and we'll drop there. Twente is about 20 miles away from Rangoon. They say, oh, no, you can't go back plane. We haven't got any plane to spare. Well, I said, well, what about a seaplane? You've got some. Oh, no, can't have that. You'll go by MLs. So the next morning...
ML?
Yes, a motor launch. So the next morning we went on board the flagship. I've forgotten the name of it. I did know it, but I've forgotten it. And there we met the commanding officer, whose name I've forgotten, but he was called Curly, because he had no hair. And he told us, will you go, please go to Twente and re-establish order amongst the troop of Hong San. So he put us on board 1 ML, and there was a small flotilla of 3. And the the CO there said, have breakfast, bacon and eggs? I said, yes, please. So went to the wardroom, had our bacon and eggs, and looked to the porthole. I saw we were going down the Irrawaddy. I said, hey, why do we go down the Irrawaddy? Twente is through the canal. It's on the other side. Oh, no. My orders is to go down the Irrawaddy and China Creek. So I said, well, I'm sorry, but it's going to take 3 days to get there, and I don't see why, because you're going through a mined channel. Please, may we go back? Ah, yes, the ship name was the Barracuda. That was the flagship. So we went back to the Barracuda, and I saw Curly, and I said to him, look, the 20 Canal is mine. I didn't know they had blown up a few ships there already, but... And I said, to go to 20, you've got a perfectly good canal, and you can be there in 10 minutes. Why go all the way around? I say, our agent on the spot reported the 20 Canal is heavily mined, and the only way to go through is through China Creek. So I said, your agent there, it's me. He wouldn't hear. So we had to go through China Cree. China Cree, we got there sometimes around about lunchtime, and of course there's a very big tide there. And within 20 minutes, we were exactly on 2 inches of water. The whole flotilla, supposed to have Japanese all around, of course they had gone by then. So the sailors had to go ashore, cut a few trees to prop up the motor launches and move all the things on decks to balance. So I took a photograph, and I was promised never to disclose the photograph of the British Navy high and dry. Eventually we got to Myeongya, and there was no trouble there whatsoever. The Aung San's troop had disappeared.
So had there been trouble?
Not that I know of. Nobody complained. I didn't see any damage, or nobody complained. So we stayed there for a while. We stayed there for several times. But to become friendly with an Anglo-Indian, and he had a lovely time. And I suppose he told you about it. But that was not that wasn't in Burma.
What was this?
Yes, he was in Burma. Yes, he was in Burma, and he came afterwards.
Who was it?
Anglo-Burmese radio operator we had. Well, I don't remember him in Burma, although he was Burmese. Now he came to us to Siam. Because after Burma, I went to Indochina.
How did that come about?
Well, I'll just say, you finished in Burma. Burma is now, well, practically liberated. There was still some fighting somewhere. But, your mission's finished. You go to Indochina.
This was in June 45, was it?
Exactly, I don't know, yes. I mean, I did find out a few dates there because I looked
yes,
up
I think
some of my records.
June.
So we went to Paxi. How we got there, I don't know.
What was your mission supposed to be there?
We were supposed to be observer on the Mekong, but it turned out that the French ex-SOE were by now commanding Laos troops in the jungle on the east side of the Mekong, and they were fighting the start of the Vietnam War. They had no ammunition, they had no money, they had no food, so they used to get it from us. Up till one day we were told to, by Darzalieu, because French troop had landed by that time in Saigon, and Darzalieu, who was the big white chief, said no more British people in Indochina. So I had to cross the Mekong, and then we established ourselves at Mok Dah Han in Siam. And there, from there on, I bought a kind of flatboat with an engine, Japanese engine, and I used to go across once or twice a week across the Mekong to give food, ammunition, and money to my French friends who were fighting the Vietnamese, or the Chinese in those days. The Chinese commander, a major, was on the other side of the river. And every night he used to send a few bullets and a few shells in my compound, then invite me for lunch the next day. And when asked, why do you do that, I say, my through an interpreter, and with his wife there, so it was a great honor. I mean, he received me as a friend. He said, well, my troops are very new.